in the days of old Lang Syne.
Greetings, this is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare, and it's my pleasure to be standing in today for the great voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA, and you can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. It's almost New Year's Eve, and since I won't have the privilege of being with you tomorrow on New Year's Eve, I've put together a celebration of sorts just for you and me. That's Auld Lang Syne you hear in the background, and I played that for you because it's the most traditional way of ringing in the new year, but there's also an interesting story behind it. The fact is that that song is usually attributed to the Scottish poet Robert Burns, but he didn't compose it. He simply wrote it down in a recently uncovered letter to a friend, written, of course, a long time ago. He explained that there was an old Scottish song that was very close to his heart. It thrilled his soul, he said, so he wrote it down. And that's a version of what you've just heard, Auld Lang Syne. And of course, the part of it that's most familiar to us is, we'll take a cup of kindness yet for Auld Lang Syne. Hope you'll have many cups of kindness offered to you in the new year. One of the things I thought we should begin with today is remembering some of the great human beings who left this earth in 2013 and left behind for us a legacy that we can celebrate. Margaret Thatcher, most importantly. Later on in the hour, we'll be talking with Ambassador John Bolton, the expert who can poke holes in Saturday's New York Times pretend report that the attack on the diplomatic mission in Benghazi was due to the video. I'm laughing because after a whole year, they're still trying to sell that story. It's going to be key to Hillary Clinton's presidential platform. We'll also be talking about Obamacare, of course, and superbugs, the president's lawlessness, and looking ahead to what's likely to happen politically in 2014. And just as a special present, I even have some book recommendations for you. But let's start with some of the great human beings who left something special for us when they departed in 2013. Here's one you might not have heard of. I hadn't until I read about him. Doug Engelbart, 88. He invented the computer mouse, left behind something that shapes all of our lives. Yep. And Thomas E. Hutchinson, he may not have changed your life unless you're severely disabled, but he developed a way for people who are quadriplegics or paralyzed from the neck down to communicate by sending commands to a computer with their eyelids. In other words, just blinking, they can talk to the rest of us. Pretty impressive. Now, everyone knows that one of the greats who left this world in 2013 and just recently was Nelson Mandela. He's been celebrated widely in the media in the last few weeks. He died at 95. He was the great leader who struggled against apartheid in South Africa and won a Nobel Prize for his efforts and the gratitude of people all around the world. But I've saved my special tribute for the person closest to my heart, Margaret Thatcher. And I actually had the privilege of knowing her. She was a fellow at the Hudson Institute when I was, quite a few years ago. We even spent a weekend on the eastern shore of Maryland together, and I was her dinner partner, seated between Margaret Thatcher and her lovely husband, Dennis, who passed away a few years ago. But it wasn't just that personal acquaintance. It was what Margaret Thatcher did for the world, because she was the greatest British leader since Winston Churchill, really the greatest leader of the Western European part of our world. She died at 87 earlier this year. She was Britain's first female prime minister, but it's not just a matter of being a woman. She had a strength of purpose, a belief in freedom, matched only by Ronald Reagan. She grew up in an apartment above the grocery store that her father and mother ran, came from very modest background, and she reflected the values that her father taught her. That's something else that she and I share. My father was definitely the most important person in my life. He taught her never to go with the herd if you think the herd is wrong. And she was particularly affected by his accounts of the brutalities during World War II and the accounts of a young Austrian Jew whom her father sheltered during the war. As a result of that, she became so committed to preserving freedom. And that, as I said, is one thing she shared with her close friend, Ronald Reagan. It was, in fact, their common commitment to defeating the Soviet Union. That's how she earned that name, Iron Lady. She was an economic liberal, in the true sense of the word liberal, not today's use of the word liberal, but liberal as John Locke defined the term liberal. I remember a reporter once called me when I was running for office the first time. I was busy cooking dinner for my family, and she said, I just have one question. She wouldn't get off the phone. She finally said, "Who's your favorite liberal?" I said, "John Locke," and she hung up on me. But John Locke was my favorite liberal, and Margaret Thatcher's too. But she was also very influenced by Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman. And she shrunk the size of Great Britain's government, privatizing industries like the steel industry and the coal industry. She earned a lot of enemies as a result, but she launched Britain on a path to prosperity. Of course, I liked her most for her candor and her commitment to freedom. And one of her most unforgettable moments is when she met Mikhail Gorbachev for the first time. He came to England, and it was arranged that they would have lunch together. And soon after they were seated, she leaned over to Gorbachev and she said, "Just to make sure there won't be any misunderstandings, I want to tell you where I stand. I hate communism." Yeah, well, you know where I stand. I hate Obamacare. Just the way Margaret Thatcher would. So this year, as we ring out the year, we can certainly pay a well-earned tribute to Margaret Thatcher. As we ring out the year, there's a phrase that's familiar. Do you know where it comes from? Another British poet laureate, Alfred Lord Tennyson. He wrote something that's repeated almost as often as Auld Lang Syne. I'll read it to you just so you remember it. "Ring out, wild bells, to the wild sky, the flying cloud, the frosty light. The year is dying in the night. Ring out, wild bells, and let him die. Ring out the old, ring in the new." That's the passage, of course, everyone quotes. "Ring out the old, ring in the new. Ring happy bells across the snow. The year is going, let him go. Ring out the false and ring in the true." Let's hope we can do that this year. Ring out all the Obama whoppers and ring in some truth. Unfortunately, as we ring in the new year, we're ringing in so many new laws. That's the bad news. Listen to this. 40,000 new state laws will go into effect on January 1st. 40,000. Arkansas voters will now have to show an ID at polling places. That's a pretty good one. Listen to this wacky one. In California, school kids are allowed to use whatever bathroom is consistent, not with their gender, but with their gender identity. So girls, you might see a lot of boys in the girls' room from now on. Okay, how's this one? State laws are going to be banning smoking in motor vehicles if children are present. Boy, there's the nanny state gone wacky. And minimum wage laws are going to make it harder for kids, especially African-American teenagers, to get jobs because they're the ones who work most often in fast foods, and those higher minimum wage laws are going to make it tough to get a job. They're also going to try and ban e-cigarettes. This is really misguided. I'm just amazed. The FDA is going to limit advertising on e-cigarettes, I'm told. They're considering it right now. The New York City Council, which is to the left of Karl Marx, is going to outlaw e-cigarettes in public places. Unfortunately, two of my three daughters smoke, and they're using e-cigarettes to get off the habit. E-cigarettes, they make a lot of sense. As you know, I spend a lot of time in hospitals, and I see people who are come in with a broken leg, for example, and suddenly they're told they can't smoke. There used to be solariums at the ends of the floor. So suddenly they have to go through something that's harder than kicking heroin at the same time they're trying to heal from their broken leg. We've got to be a little more understanding with these smokers, I believe. But we're going to be assaulted with 40,000 new state laws this year. Of course, we all know what the worst new law is. Obamacare. And we'll be talking about that after the break. So much more to come as we celebrate the ringing out of the old and the ringing in of the new. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the great voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. This is your healthy radio addiction.
Let's start the new year right. 12 o'clock tonight. When they dim the light, let's begin.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Kissing the old year out.
I'll be bringing in a brand new year. Bringing in a brand new year. So listen, dear, won't you meet me here?
Glad you stayed with me, Bubba. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare, celebrating New Year's Eve with you just a bit early. I'm so glad you're here to celebrate with me. And we were just about to talk about Obamacare. Unfortunately, we have Claudia on the line with a question about Obamacare. Thanks for calling in, Claudia.
Betsy, I'm so thrilled to talk to you. I'm a tremendous admirer of yours.
Well, thank you.
And it's been really a treat to hear you sub for Laura recently. In fact, I have a two-part question. I really have two questions. One is, you know, there's been a lot of very interesting, exciting, creative alternative suggestions to Obamacare, and I don't know how to join the conversation. For example, the latest, you know, time I tried, when Tom Price had some idea, you can't send him an email unless you live in Georgia. And, like, all the people in Congress, like, when they start coming up with ideas. So, in other words, if my congressman or representatives, you know, whatever, here in New Jersey aren't taking up the ball, I have no voice. I don't understand how our country works. How do I contact these guys?
Well, I agree. It is really tough to get through to those politicians. But let's talk about this for a minute, because the fact is we have an opportune moment here. More and more Democrats, especially in the U.S. Senate, and especially those who are up for re-election this year, they would like to wake up on January 1st or 2nd and see no more health exchanges, no more controversial navigators, no more individual mandate and penalties for those who don't sign up. They would like to be done with this. And so this is an opportune moment to offer alternatives. And in fact, I've offered one that includes some of Tom Price's proposals. Tom Price's bill, like most of the Republican bills currently being discussed, promised to lower the cost of health insurance. And don't forget, that's what President Obama promised at the beginning. So that would mean allowing people to shop across state lines, since health insurance is so much cheaper in some states and than in others, because some states don't load up the law with mandates requiring that everybody buy the most costly plans. A good example is if you live in California and you're a 25-year-old man, until until Obamacare came along, you could buy health insurance for about a third of what somebody in New York or New Jersey paid. So buying, shopping across state lines makes a lot of sense. Tort reform or medical liability reform makes a lot of sense because that's one of the things pushing up the cost of doctors' care, the fact that they have to buy these costly medical liability insurance plans every year. And then mandate reform, what I referred to just a moment ago, let people pick the kind of health insurance they want. You live in Jersey. It's very similar to what we have in New York, only New Jersey did follow some wise reforms a couple of years ago. In New York, the law says the only health insurance you're allowed to buy is a fully loaded plan. It's got 52 extras. It would be like passing a law that the only car you're allowed to buy is a fully loaded Cadillac. What if you only want a Nissan, right? Or a VW Bug? So people should, the presumption that politicians make is, we're too stupid to pick what we want, right? And that's what Obamacare is about. They've passed a law that everybody has to have the one-size-fits-all government-designed health plan, right? You can see how much it costs. Premiums are up 41% over what people in the individual market paid last year. And the reason is, the assumption is, you have to have everything in that one-size-fits-all plan. So, as I said, it would be like passing a law that car dealers can only sell you the four-door sedan, no hatchbacks, no convertibles. The politicians were assuming we're too stupid to even know when to put the top up. So that's giving consumers choice. That's a big part of the reform. But I think we need to go a little further than many of the Republicans have. And I would do two things. I would have a COBRA subsidy, which was tried a couple of years ago with quite a bit of success. So when people get laid off at work, they have help paying their insurance premium till they get another job, like a 6-month subsidy available, because that's when it's hardest to pay for your insurance. And also, I would fully fund the pre-existing condition pools in many states. I'm so glad you called, Claudia. Let's continue this discussion sometime soon. Call in anytime, and Happy New Year.
Can I say any more for now?
Well, if you hold on till after the break, I don't want to cut you off, but we're hitting a break.
Okay.
Hold on, and we'll be back.
I was watching the news. Turns out home burglaries skyrocket around the holidays. It got me thinking. I'm traveling a lot for work, so what if that happened to my house? Worse yet, what if my family were home? My family's safety is my responsibility. That's why I looked into home security. I checked all my options, and the best technology for the best price came from Vivint. Yes, Vivint gives me a complete security system, but their video technology is unreal. I can see what's going on in my home right from my smartphone, tablet, or computer. I can even lock the doors remotely if my kids forget. Best yet, I got Vivint's no equipment costs and free install deal. $1,300 worth of camera and security equipment at no charge.
And Happy New Year to you. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare. I'm standing in for the voice of Liberty, Laura Ingraham, and we're celebrating New Year's a little early. And on the line with us is the foremost expert on the United States position in the world, former ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, now a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And I'm especially excited that he's with us because on Saturday, the New York Times published, well, I don't know whether you'd call it a report. I would call it an editorial or maybe a campaign platform for Hillary Clinton, contending that the attack on our mission in Benghazi was due to, yes, a video. Ambassador Bolton, thank you so much for joining us. What are your thoughts on this New York Times quote report, close quote?
Hi, Betsy. How are you? Well, I think you put your finger on it. This is really an editorial. I mean, this was reporting in search of an ideological objective. And, you know, there's so many things wrong with it, it's hard to know where to begin. Let's just take the first one, that after months of investigative reporting, the New York Times has concluded that, in fact, it was the Mohammed video that set off the attack that killed Ambassador Stevens and three others last September the 11th. You know, after a year of being able to concoct a cover story, you'd think that the terrorist could come up with something better than what President Obama and Secretary of State Clinton were saying within days of the attack. You know, obviously, this is a line of defense that's intended to appeal to the people who sit in the White House, no less, who don't think there should be a war on terrorism, that al-Qaeda is on the run, Osama bin Laden is dead. And the New York Times just walked right into it, despite reporting, as many observant commentators have pointed out, despite reporting in the New York Times itself that contradicts that. And this is the sort of thing, it permeates the article. It's really, I would think, an embarrassment even to the New York Times.
Even to the New York Times. And what about the contradictions with all the testimony before Congress?
Well, you know, that's the other key point is that really it wasn't an al-Qaeda planned attack. It was by people who, yes, they're terrorists, but they're not somehow fixed into the al-Qaeda table of organization as if it's a corporate hierarchy or a government bureaucracy. I think we've known for years that al-Qaeda has a very loose structure. People are affiliated with it, not affiliated with it. It changes day to day. And that suits al-Qaeda because it allows what in antitrust terms they used to call flying in formation, that is to say, achieving the same objective without sitting around a boardroom making up a conspiracy. I don't know why it's hard for the New York Times to figure that out, but I think that's clearly what was going on. Our people on the ground, as you say, understood it not just the day of the attack, not just in the days after the attack, they understood it before the attack, and that's why they were pleading for more security because of the very threatening environment in and around Benghazi.
And what did the New York Times report do with that piece of information, the fact that the security was inadequate despite requests from on the ground?
Well, you know, somehow that just kind of gets lost in the shuffle. But the fundamental point that this article misses, the same analysis that's been true for over a year now, is that the administration failed before the attack to provide adequate security because of their ideology that the war on terror was over. They had gotten rid of Gaddafi. Therefore, what's happening in Libya must be okay. They failed on the day of the attack to provide any kind of backup. And they have failed consistently and egregiously for 15 months to retaliate for this attack or even, in their words, bring the perpetrators to justice. And so the lesson that remains more than 15 months after Benghazi is you can kill Americans and get away with it.
Well, and as you pointed out in a recent column, which I hope everyone will be able to read, you said Nero in the White House. Nero fiddled, so Rome burned, and Mr. Obama is fiddling too.
Well, he fundamentally doesn't care about national security affairs. It's one of the reasons he is the most radical president we've ever had. Every other American president since Franklin Roosevelt and the attack on Pearl Harbor has gotten up every morning, their first thought being, what threats does the United States face in the world? That's not what Obama thinks about. He thinks about saving Obamacare these days, but he'll think about some other way to transform our domestic society on some other day. This is a disease that's eating away at us, that we see our national security slipping in place after place around the world. Benghazi is one of the worst examples of it, but people need to understand this is going on a continuing basis as both friends and adversaries alike around the world see a weak, inattentive president, and they make their calculations accordingly to our detriment.
Well, and of course, Obama has used the trust but verify platform in addressing Iran, but you say he's not actually in a position to verify.
No, and this is a huge weakness in this whole theory. You know, when Ronald Reagan quoted that Russian proverb, I always thought it was with a great sense of irony because I don't think he really trusted them either, and he knew that there was a heavy burden on the United States and its own intelligence gathering capabilities to know what was happening with the Russian strategic nuclear force. We don't have those intelligence capabilities today. We don't have good intelligence from inside Iran. And the international agencies that will be doing the inspecting aren't capable of gathering that information. I mean, that's just one of many reasons why the Geneva Agreement's a bad one. And it's coming unraveled right in front of us, as the Iranians proclaimed just a few days ago. They've got yet more advanced centrifuges to enrich uranium that they're developing, even as the Geneva Accord is still being touted by the White House as a great success.
And finally, we're looking at some potential threats from China.
Well, you know, the Chinese have been behaving in a very assertive, almost belligerent fashion for some years now, making claims in the East China Sea, the South China Sea. These are not territorial claims in remote areas that don't affect us. These are claims over international waterways that are key links in international commerce for Korea, for Japan, that vitally affect the United States. And the Obama administration is just absent from the field on this. They barely have a presence there. China knows this. They can see our shrinking defense budget, our shrinking naval capabilities. They are challenging our position in the Western Pacific in a way we haven't seen since the end of World War II. What do you hear about this from the president? Zip.
And, of course, with these huge cuts in military capability, we are becoming weaker and weaker.
Well, this is exactly the downward spiral that we face. It's both a real problem and a perceptual problem. And that's where whether their friends or adversaries see a weak and inattentive United States, they begin to think how they're either going to take advantage of it if there are adversaries, or how they're going to protect themselves separately from the United States if there are friends. And both of those trends are ultimately very, very damaging to the United States and those friends and allies who stick with us. You know, ask Israel what it's like to be an ally of the United States under the Obama administration.
A pretty shaky proposition.
Right, exactly.
That's right. Well, what would you do right now, if you became Secretary of State, how would you put us back on the right course?
Well, the first thing I'd do would be to abandon the Obama-John Kerry approach that says all problems in the Middle East spring from Israel's activities in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. The focus on trying to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian dispute has sucked attention away from what the real issue in the Middle East is, and I think the most pressing, most urgent threat we have today, which is Iran's nuclear weapons program. The administration's deal in Geneva gives Iran what it most wants. I think we ought to be, instead of trying to dismantle the sanctions, I think we ought to be looking at what it's going to take to eliminate the Iranian nuclear weapons program. It's a very unattractive proposition, but that to me is the highest priority.
And is it true then, as Norman Podoritz argued, that we have a choice now between the risk of conventional warfare with Iran now or nuclear warfare in the near future?
Yeah, I think this has been true for some time. My own view has been you've got a choice now between a preemptive military strike against Iran's nuclear weapons program or Iran with nuclear weapons. The possibility of preemptive action, as I said a moment ago, is unattractive, but the prospect of Iran with nuclear weapons is deeply threatening to Israel, to Arab friends in the region, and it doesn't stop with Iran, because if Iran gets nuclear weapons, it's only a matter of time before Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey, perhaps others, also get nuclear weapons. And this is the essence of the threat of nuclear proliferation, and it's like the Obama administration just whistling past the graveyard.
No one knows the United Nations, its strengths and weaknesses, better than you do. Is there any way we can rely on the United Nations, or is that just an empty promise?
No, I think you can basically forget about the United Nations. The International Atomic Energy Agency can do some important work if it's properly backed up by the United States. But let's be clear, if you want to stop nuclear proliferation in the world, only the United States and its allies, led by us, are capable of doing it. And what the lesson of Iran is, and by the way, the continuing lesson of North Korea, also a nuclear power now, is that if the United States does not act effectively, any country that's determined to get nuclear weapons can get them. And that is a frightening prospect going forward.
And what should we have done vis-a-vis North Korea and its nuclear capabilities?
Well, I think we should have squeezed them much harder, much earlier, and kept the squeeze on. And most importantly, we should have gone to China, which says it does not want a nuclear North Korea, and said to China, you uniquely have the ability to change that regime in North Korea. Our ultimate goal should be unification, but in the shorter term, China could have prevented a nuclear North Korea. And we should have said, unless you do what you are uniquely capable of doing, it will affect in a very bad way your relations with the United States. We weren't willing to do that. It was a huge mistake.
Well, now we look at China as less of an ally vis-a-vis North Korea and more of an independent threat to us. Isn't that true?
Well, I think that's growing, and I think that's part of the problem. Within China, there's a debate about what to do with North Korea, but the fact is, at high levels in both our government and our business community, people have not seen that China can be both a collaborator, an economic competitor, but a potential political military adversary as well. I'm not advocating confrontation with China. In fact, I think a stronger American posture would make confrontation less likely.
That's right. And in fact, we've always, in the recent past, we've approached China as its growth being, quote, a peaceful rise. But in fact, there are two sides to that coin.
Well, exactly. And that's why, you know, the Ronald Reagan policy, which he always liked to characterize as peace through strength in dealing with the Soviet Union and elsewhere, really applies with China as well. The threat is increasing that China will miscalculate in the East China Sea and the South China Sea with respect to South Korea, Japan. It's a long, long list because they see a weak United States.
Yes. Ambassador, let me just say before we go on, thank you so much for this fantastic briefing as we've gone around the globe with you. I hope you will join us again soon in the new year. No one knows these issues better than you do and is more vigilant on behalf of the United States than you are. Thank you so much. We've been talking with Ambassador John Bolton. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham, celebrating a bit early New Year's Eve.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
It's just another New Year's Eve, another night like all the rest.
Welcome back, Bubbleheads. Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. We're celebrating New Year's Eve a bit early. A celebration, just you and me looking back on the year that's passed. One of the things that happened this year was a great movie called Captain Phillips. And the reason I'm raising it is that we've just been talking with Ambassador John Bolton, former ambassador to the United Nations and a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And he was blasting, poking holes in Saturday's New York Times quote report. It was really not a report. It was an editorial claiming that the attack on our mission in Benghazi was due to that preposterous video rather than to Al-Qaeda. But of course, the biggest question that's unanswered is why didn't anyone rescue those men at the mission? And when I went to see Captain Phillips, if you haven't seen it, go see it or watch it at home now. It's available everywhere. The story is about a dramatic rescue in 2009. Somali pirates hijacked a cargo ship called the Maersk Alabama and took its captain, Captain Phillips, for ransom. What did the United States do? Well, they sent three Navy warships, two helicopters, a surveillance drone, and parachuted in Navy SEALs to rescue Captain Phillips. I mean, it was a thriller. It was I stood up in the movie theater. I was so proud to be an American watching this rescue go on. Okay. And then, of course, Phillips was in this little boat where he had been dragged by his captors. And the president himself gave the authorization for sharpshooters to kill the pirates and rescue Captain Phillips. And of course, as I saw that dramatic rescue, I said to myself, where was the president on the night of September 11th? Where was the president on the night of September 11th, 2012, when the mission was attacked in Benghazi? That's the question we've never gotten an answer to. Where was Hillary Clinton? Where was the president? And why did they do nothing to rescue our ambassador and three other brave Americans who died that night? That is the answer we don't have. And nothing in Saturday's New York Times pretend report gives us an answer to that critical question. Amazingly, CNN got to Benghazi before our military forces after that attack. What does that say? It's so shocking. When we come back, we're going to be talking to another expert on the decline of American power, Herbert London, Dr. Herbert London from the London Center and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. We've got so much ahead on this celebration of New Year's Eve. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. Wilson Pickett, this is one of my favorites. It is so nice to ring out the old and ring in the new with you. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the great voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle, and you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. And on the phone with us now is one of the premier experts on American foreign policy, Dr. Herbert London from the London Center and also a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. And I'm excited to be talking with her because he really understands the fallacies of this report that came out in the New York Times on Saturday. I use the word report very loosely. Thank you, Herb, for joining us.
Betsy, always a pleasure to be with you, and let me take this opportunity to also wish you all the best for the new year and to congratulate you on the extraordinary job you're doing in replacing Laura Ingraham.
Well, standing in for her. Thank you. But tell us, I know that you have combed over this New York Times report because you know the subject so well. What's behind this, do you think? Is this?
Well, it strains credulity. Let me put it that way. You have to wonder about the motives. Is this something that was put up by the Hillary Clinton crowd in anticipation of what is likely to be the most vulnerable area for campaign for presidency, the presidency? It's very difficult to know what goes into this report, the so-called report. But it does strain credulity. I mean, you ask yourself some very obvious questions. The report maintains, for example, that this was not a spontaneous attack. Well, how could it be a spontaneous attack if 200 trucks come together at the same time, all well-armed, with mortars that are fairly sophisticated, on 9/11. I mean, you'd have to be someone who is a complete innocent to believe that this was done without any kind of planning. The second thing that, of course, strains credulity is the whole issue of this al-Sharia. Al-Sharia has been named as one of the adjuncts of the al-Qaeda group for a year or two. And it was very obvious after the fall of the Libyan government that al-Sharia was considered to be one of the terrorist groups in this area. To now suggest that it's not tied to al-Qaeda is on some level rather absurd, because Mike Rogers, among others, and others in the intelligence community, and in fact many of the intelligence experts across the globe, have been saying for a long time now that these two organizations are united in some fashion. And of course, there are many adjuncts to al-Qaeda, and this is merely one of them.
And so Peter King made that point too, didn't he, that this is engaging in semantics to say that this particular al-Sharia is not part of al-Qaeda.
Well, it is a semantical argument, no question about it. And the other thing, of course, that is so interesting is the argument is made in this report that it was the film that was largely responsible for eliciting this response, this attack on the embassy. Now, here's a trailer of an obscure film made by an even more obscure filmmaker. That means that there would have to be hundreds of people that saw this film almost at the same time or about the same time and were activated as a result of this film. Again, when that comment was made to the chief of the deputy chief of the delegation in Benghazi, he said, "This explanation is, to quote him, an embarrassment."
Yes.
He didn't believe that it was true. And of course, how could it be true? It strains credulity as well. And for this report to reiterate this point, suggesting that it was the film that was largely responsible for prompting the attack, is on some level rather absurd.
That's right. So now the question is, I haven't heard from anyone who gives credence to this report from the New York Times, even people on the left. They're just being silent. Am I correct?
Well, so far, I mean, I've talked to a number of people about it, and everyone has the same sort of response. Well, they did a lot of research, and it's a question of who you talk to. Well, of course it's a question of who you talk to. I mean, I can talk to some people on the streets in Benghazi, and they'll tell me that there wasn't even an attack. I mean, I think it's absurd. You've got to talk to people who have a level of credibility. The problem, however, is that who knows who was actually who discussed this matter and how this investigation was conducted. The problem, of course, is that you can conduct an investigation on anything, as you well know, write a report, and the report can obviously reinforce your judgments that you go into the report with. That is very often a problem with this kind of standard. This is not a journalistic standard as far as I'm concerned. It was not done dispassionately. There was clearly an agenda, and the agenda and the conclusions, I think, are fairly obvious.
And also, this report doesn't answer some of the questions that are most important to Americans. For example, what was the president doing that night?
Exactly. What was the president doing that night? To what degree could reinforcements have been provided on that occasion? Why is it that the administration did not respond to the initial request for reinforcements when they were made weeks before the actual attack took place? Why did Hillary Clinton make this absurd comment during the Senate testimony that this does not make any difference, it doesn't make any difference? I mean, there are so many questions of that kind that are not addressed in this report. And so this, in some respects, is not only simplistic, but it is only partial. It's only a partial report. It does not deal with some of the essential questions that you've just raised.
That's right. And actually, while you're on the phone with us, Herb, it's so exciting to be talking with you today because we were just discussing Lady Thatcher. And few Americans knew Lady Thatcher any better than you did. You hosted her at the Hudson Institute. What are your thoughts looking back on the year and the departure of Lady Thatcher?
Well, Lady Thatcher was one of the great figures of our time. In some sense, she was almost Churchillian. She stood up to almost all of the forces against her, and by dint of the fact that she was the Iron Lady, did prevail. She was a remarkable woman in many ways, and I felt very privileged to have a chance to take long walks with her in the evening when we spent some time together at Weston Park. And she was a remarkable person. She also was deeply devoted to Ronald Reagan. That came through in one of our discussions where she continually referred to someone called the Great One. When she said the Great One, I thought she was referring to Churchill. But in the end, she was referring to Ronald Reagan, who she did have enormous admiration for. They didn't always agree, but she recognized something quite special about this man. And she was indeed one of the great special figures of our lifetime. In my judgment, truly one of the pantheon of heroes and heroines that we have had the great pleasure of living with.
Yes, and unfortunately, her life is not as celebrated, even in England, as I would have expected. The media have labeled her controversial, when in fact her contributions to the history of liberty are undisputed.
Well, this is what really has to be understood. She stood up to the Coal Workers Union. She was responsible for engaging in a war to protect interests of the UK at a time when it was thousands of miles away from the United Kingdom, but she recognized what was at stake in that war. She was a person who had deep convictions to the free market and was willing to put her own political life on the line in order to make sure that those values would continue. She was someone who was unique because she was a person of deep convictions. And when you consider the fact that the Conservative Party or the Tory Party has gone wet And when you consider the fact that the Labour Party is in some degree in ascendancy, it's obvious that they now consider her a controversial figure. But when you look at it from the standpoint of how you preserve liberty in our time, you'd have to say that Lady Thatcher is one of the hallmarks of those people who stood by the defense of liberty as we want it and understand it.
It stood by the defense of liberty and also the defense of Great Britain, the defense of her own country. Her backbone is an embarrassment to those who go weak, such as President Obama.
Well, it's easy to recall what has happened in the past, but we often forget what's happened in the distant past. This appears like the distant past. She was the Iron Lady because she was a person of such firm conviction. She had backbone at a time when most politicians suffer from a form of osteoporosis. So I have great admiration for this woman because she was someone who stood by her convictions, was willing to defend them, and obviously those convictions were undergirded by her belief in liberty, liberty as the ultimate source of strength in the Western civilization.
And, of course, she was blunt in her defense of political freedom and economic freedom against the likes of Mikhail Gorbachev.
Well, exactly. I mean, she understood what a free market can do. There are so few politicians who really understand this. They become so involved in the government being the only solution to economic woe that they overlook what the free market can really provide. Look, the free market has its flaws, but it is by far the single most important development when it comes to economic history in the world. We often overlook it. We take it for granted. And even in our own country, we're losing sight of the role that the free market should play in addressing the economic problems that we face.
And as she often said, without economic liberty, there can be no true political liberty. If we don't have control over the fruits of our labors, we're not really free.
Look, a point that's been made by Milton Friedman many times, and a point that I clearly believe in. If you do not have economic freedom, you're going to lose your political freedom. And we are certainly moving down that path, a path that worries me a great deal.
Yes, that is really, I think, the biggest challenge in the year ahead politically. Never mind what the politicians want to put on the agenda, whether it's immigration reform or this or that. The fact is that government is taking too big a share of the fruits of our labor, as much as when you add up federal, state, and local government, they're spending 42% of GDP. 42% of everything you and I and everyone else goes out and produces every day at work. And I know I'm not getting 42% of my happiness from government.
Well, I can also assure you that what's happening is every time a government takes a dollar and puts it into the public sector, it's taking a dollar out of the private sector. The shrinking of the private sector is what concerns me. If you do not have the initiative in the private sector, the ability to innovate, the capital that's necessary as an incubator for new ideas and for new products, you've got a real problem. And that is the real test of our future. Can we regain the kind of innovative edge that made the United States so unique? And the only way that happens is through a free market and through a limited government. The longer the government continues to expand, the worse it becomes for the innovative and exciting and initiatives that are necessary in order to sustain the growth of our economy.
So resolution number one in the new year, we all have to fight for less government spending. So glad you joined us, Herb. Happy
Always
New Year to you and
you.
Yours. Right.
Take this care.
Is this is Betsy McCoy standing in for the great voice of freedom, Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction, 855-40-LAURA.
The Laura Ingram Show.
It's gonna be a funky new year. Come on, sing it with me. Funky new year.
Actually, it's New Year's in politics here. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingram. So glad you stayed with us. We have a lot going on here. We're going to be talking a bit about politics in the new year and Obamacare. We were discussing Obamacare earlier in the show, and then we had two fantastic guests, Dr. Herbert London and Ambassador John Bolton, fill us in on the preposterous story published by the New York Times Saturday claiming that the attack on Benghazi was the result of that spurious video. So here we are, finally, with a moment to discuss Obamacare. And you've heard about all the whoppers. 2013 was the year of the Obamacare whoppers, one lie after another being disclosed. For example, the president's assurance voiced many times that if you like your health plan, you can keep your health plan, period. Well, we know that's not true. Over 6 million plans have already been canceled because they don't comply with Obamacare. Or how about this one? You're going to save $2,500 a year. No, that's been proven false as well. Premiums in the individual market are up on average 41% this year compared with last year, according to the Manhattan Institute, and on and on. But there is one whopper that no one is discussing yet. And I thought we ought to talk about it for a second because it's the one that's going to touch you in the most personal way. Remember when the president said again and again, quote, "You're not going to have anybody getting in between you and your doctor and your decision making," close quote. He said it many, many times. But it was a lie from day one, just like the president's other sales pitches were lies. And this whopper is really going to affect you in a terrible way in some instances. Let me explain what I'm talking about. There is a section in this law called Section 1311H1B that gives the Secretary of Health and Human Services blanket authority to dictate how doctors treat privately insured patients. It prohibits the insurance company from paying any doctor who doesn't comply with whatever regulations the secretary imposes in the name of quality. Well, that can mean anything. When your doctor chooses to use a stent, when your OBGYN orders a sonogram or a mammogram, your doctor's decisions are going to be monitored for compliance with the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who, by the way, is not a doctor. And your doctor might be in the hard place of having to choose between doing what's right for you and avoiding those government penalties. So those rules are now being written. They haven't been rolled out yet, but they will be in 2015. And that may be the rudest awakening of all when you see the kind of tightening control the federal government is going to have over your doctor, even though you're in a private health insurance plan you paid for yourself. A congressman named Phil Gingrey from Georgia has introduced a bill to repeal Section 1311H1B because he warns that under this blanket authority, the secretary, for example, could order doctors to stop doing mammogram screenings for women under age 50, even though many cancer organizations say it should start at age 40. So this is really serious business and probably the most dangerous lie in Obamacare. I did want to talk with you about one other, though, and that is seniors, because cuts to Medicare pay for over half this law. That's right. Cuts to Medicare pay for over half this giant law, which is here on my desk. And seniors are already feeling the brunt of this. For example, Medicare Advantage plans, over a quarter of seniors are in Medicare Advantage plans. And now many of the doctors participating in those plans are being cut out of those plans because the federal government is paying those plans less than in the past. Yep. The federal government is cutting $716 billion out of future Medicare spending, and the result is that seniors are going to get less care. The average senior will get $1,400 less care in 2017 than if this law hadn't passed. And you're already seeing it when you go into the hospital because hospitals are getting the biggest cuts. So if you're a patient of any age, it's going to be harder to get a nurse. You push that button for help, and you're going to wait longer because hospitals are responding to these cuts by laying off nurses and spreading the care thinner. So when we get back, we're going to talk more about Obamacare and the political repercussions. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingram, on your healthy radio addiction. Give us a call about Obamacare or anything else. 855-40-LAURA. We're celebrating New Year's just a bit early. Welcome back. It's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the Voice of Liberty, Laura Ingram. We were just talking about Obamacare. And if you'd like to join the conversation, 855-40-LAURA. The board is lit up. And we've got Patricia from California.
Hi, Betsy.
Glad to have you on the line.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, we know that over $700 billion is being taken from Medicare to finance Obamacare. Does this mean that the money that the people are paying on their out of their paychecks toward Medicare, that's labeled Medicare on their pay stubs, is actually going to Obamacare instead? And how is that legal?
Yes, let me explain that the money that was budgeted for future Medicare spending, $716 billion is being reduced from that spending budget and shifted over to largely fund a vast expansion of Medicaid. So it's like robbing grandma to spread the wealth. And you have a good nose for politics, Patricia, because not only are they doing that, but this law imposes two new taxes that are called Medicare. One is a Medicare investment tax, 3.8% on people who sell things like a lakeside cottage or a stock or a bond or some other asset they have. And in addition to paying capital gains, they're going to have to pay this 3.8%. But that money is not going into Medicare, even though it's labeled a Medicare investment tax. It's going to fund Obamacare. And the same thing is true for the hike in the Medicare payroll tax. So it's just, the law is just full of lies, and a lot of them have to do with Medicare. This is a terrible blow to seniors. This law eviscerates Medicare, and you can already see the consequences. As I said, some of the biggest cuts are in what hospitals are paid. And that impacts everyone, because when you go into the hospital, you're going to experience a lower standard of care, fewer nurses on the floor.
Is this legal? Why can't
legal.
We sue?
They passed a law to do it. That's the trouble. What's really shocking and shameful about this is the way the supporters of this law misrepresented it, and in fact lied and told seniors that they were going to benefit from this. They, as I'm sure you've heard, again and again, they emphasized the closing of the donut hole. That's an expression meaning closing of the gap in prescription drug coverage for seniors. Well, in fact, it is being closed somewhat, but that little sweetener is worth only 10% of the huge cuts in future Medicare benefits under this law. The seniors bear the entire brunt of this. It's a generational war on them.
Mm.
And let me explain that in addition to the across-the-board cuts, there are some particularly insidious parts of this law. For example, Section 3000A of this law awards bonus points to the hospitals that spend the least per senior. Not the least per patient, by the way. The least per senior. Now, think about it. I wouldn't take my beloved pooch to the vet that spent the least per animal. Why would I take my mother to the hospital that spends the least per senior?
Oh, boy.
So thank you for calling. I hate to give you such bad news. Call anytime and we'll continue this discussion. And in the meantime, I hope you enjoy a good new year.
Thank you. You too.
Claudia, we've got you on the line again. Thank you for calling back. Claudia from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, talking about Obamacare.
Yes, I so appreciate the opportunity to be part of the discussion. The reason why I had been interested in talking about alternative plans is because I have a suggestion that I think would be very effective in cutting costs. That's really original. I haven't heard anybody else say it. But if I can only say one thing, what I really wanted to know is, of the excellent plans that are out there, there's a lot of very moneyed interest, meaning the insurance industry, that politicians, including Republicans, are beholden to. And I don't know how politically we can really change into a free market system. So if you want me to skip past my suggestion and just go right to that, that's my most important.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the behavior of the insurance industry this time around, they joined with us in fighting Hillary Care. But this time around, they wanted a seat at the table. And now, frankly, they're getting their comeuppance, because the insurance industry is quickly being turned into a public utility. As you can see, Barack Obama has no respect for the rule of law or for property rights. So the insurance industry agreed to this Obamacare law, and now the president is willy-nilly changing the law day by day, and at each point, of course, trimming the profits of insurance companies. But they can hardly say anything. When you lie down with dogs, you get fleas.
Well, Betsy, do you think that will make the insurance industry more amenable to being only as profitable as P&C insurance, property and casualty, rather than with all the padding that they've enjoyed for
right.
all these
well,
years?
Right. Well, in fact, you know, their stocks have been way up in the last year. It's hard to say what's going to happen with them. And Kathleen Sebelius told Congress 2 years ago that insurance companies were in a death spiral. I do believe that Nancy Pelosi, Kathleen Sebelius, Barack Obama all want to see insurance companies go out of business as they push us towards single payer. But the fact is, we, the people, are going to stop this before it ever gets to that point. 2014 is going to be a referendum on the Obama health law. 2012 should have been, unfortunately, many voters got distracted. But 2014 will be a referendum on the Obama health law. And I'm confident that most Americans, the vast majority of voters, will go into that voting booth and pull the lever for someone who's committed to sparing the nation this tragedy.
Well, Betsy, would you like to hear my one cost-saving suggestion that hasn't been...
Why not, Claudia? You've got the mic. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Insurance is a regulated industry, so even as we talk about going to, you know, a much more free market system, it's still going to be regulated, because insurance is. And the one regulation that I think would be very helpful is if comprehensive health insurance is outlawed, and instead insurance companies are forced to offer as separate products catastrophic and routine care. And when people see that their routine care insurance, if they're basically healthy, isn't worth it, and they see that it's not free,
that's right.
If they insured for that portion of it, and they only bought catastrophic, like, you know, the same way you buy homeowners and auto.
Well, let me just jump in here.
People would begin negotiating directly with their doctors. Doctors say they could save 40% of their office operating costs if they're not dealing with insurance companies.
I agree with everything you've said except the word outlaw, because I believe that we consumers are smart and we should always have the choices. But I do also agree with you, and you've made an important point here, Claudia, that for most people, catastrophic health insurance is the smart kind, because if we pay for our routine visits to the doctor out of pocket, they'll cost about a third less. Most of us are paying premiums for care we don't need. And Obamacare, unfortunately, exacerbates that. It makes it worse. It's forcing everyone to buy the one-size-fits-all government-designed plan full of things that we don't want. And I believe in liberty. I believe that people should have the choice. Catastrophic, no insurance at all, the big comprehensive plan, whatever you want. Don't have Uncle Sam telling me how to spend my money or take care of my family. Claudia, I want to wish you a happy new year. Maybe she's off the line now. Claudia, happy new year. Hope you're listening. Andre on the line. Andre from Vero Beach.
Yeah.
Thank you for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you for being on the air. I had a couple questions and a statement. Now, under Obamacare, there's basically two groups, those that pay the insurance company for their insurance with deductibles, and then there's there's a group that doesn't pay anything and has no deductible and gets free insurance. Am I correct on that?
Well, you're talking about the exchanges, right?
Basically Obamacare.
Yeah, let me describe. There's two kinds of insurance under Obamacare. There's a vast expansion of Medicaid for people who earn under a certain amount, and there's no premium there. People get that for free. And then above that line, above that earnings line, there are the so-called private plans sold on the exchanges. Some people are eligible for big subsidies so that they pay almost nothing. Most people have to pay something. And if you're a family of four and you earn over $92,000 a year, or if you're an individual and you earn over $46,000 a year, you pay the full freight. So now you've got a picture of what's going on.
Okay. My comment basically is twofold. One, of those people who do not pay anything on insurance, I'm sure that probably at the end of the year, they're going to receive something back from the federal income, on their income tax.
Earned income tax credits, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Yeah, I remember when I had a loan out, a federal loan out, and when my income tax refund came, the federal government would attach it. Now, it's my understanding that the IRS is the arm that is collecting for Obamacare.
That's
so
right.
So that's true. Are they going to be attaching, these refunds that are coming back?
No, but they will be, according to the law. And, of course, now, day by day, the president is changing the law. So Obamacare, as it's being rolled out, bears almost no resemblance to the Affordable Care Act on my desk here. Those 2,572 pages are being whittled, mangled, distorted, repealed, delayed, amended lawlessly by the president. So one of the most recent things the president has done is to say, well, if you lost your health plan, as 6 million people have done, if you lost it because it was canceled because it didn't comply with Obamacare, we're not going to impose a penalty on you for failing to have insurance this year. So my guess is, watching what's happening in Washington and how weak-kneed the Democrats, especially in the U.S. Senate, are becoming, this whole individual penalty will be gone in a few weeks. There will be no penalty in 2014. That's my crystal ball prediction. But right now, there is a penalty, and the IRS is the enforcer, and the way they do it is to withhold part of your refund. So if you want to avoid the penalty, make sure you're not getting a refund.
Well, yeah, but see, that's going to be the other shoe that's going to drop, because there's a lot of people who don't realize that they're going to wind, that the IRS is going to wind up collecting additional funds out of their refund. So I think that's going to be interesting to see when that worm turns.
You're really right about that, Andre. I want to thank you for calling and sharing your thoughts. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the great voice of liberty, Laura Ingram. We are your healthy radio addiction. We're going to be back with more on Obamacare and superbugs and some interesting projections and predictions. Of course, they're just crystal ball types for the new year. So stay with us. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram.
The Laura Ingram Show.
Welcome back. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York, author of Beating Obamacare. Thank you for joining me for this celebration, ringing out the old and ringing in the new. We've been talking about Obamacare, which we'd like to ring out very soon. And we've got Wayne on the line with a good suggestion. Wayne from Myrtle Beach. What's on your mind, Wayne?
Well, I saw a bumper sticker I think says it all. It says Obamacare because Grandma and Grandpa are shovel ready. I think it just says it all right there.
You know, I'm so glad you called. This is a really terrible thing to realize, but Obamacare is just deadly for seniors. And I'm glad you made this call. There was a study done, published in one of the most respected peer-reviewed medical journals, a study of almost all the hospitals in the state of California, and it showed that the hospitals that spend the least per senior have substantially higher death rates for pneumonia, for cardiac arrest, for congestive heart failure, for other common maladies among the elderly. In other words, if you're treated in one of those hospitals, you have a much worse chance of making it home again. And yet here is Obamacare literally pushing all hospitals to emulate the hospitals that have the highest death rates for seniors. What can I say? It's unconscionable. Thank you for calling, Wayne, and Happy New Year. Joyce, on the line.
Hi, Betsy. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. It's just short, and I just want you to talk about it. I want, you know, there are more than just religious organizations that do not want to pay into Obamacare. I'm just an individual, and how come I can't be a conscientious objector?
Well,
I mean,
you know
I'll
what?
Pay higher taxes.
You know what?
Okay,
you ought to be able to be a conscientious objector. One way you can is to simply refuse to comply with Obamacare and pay the penalty. As you know, the first year, it's $95 or 1% of your gross adjusted income, and then it goes up pretty substantially. That's why, Joyce, we have to band together and fight Obamacare, because it shouldn't cost you so much money to maintain your personal freedom. And yes, gradually we're winning more and more cases in court where judges are saying, if you like your God, you can keep your God. If you have a religious objection, you don't have to comply with Obamacare. But it shouldn't be a religious objection, because the most important thing is our personal freedom. Am I right?
Yes, you are. Okay. And I do not like killing babies, and I'm not Catholic. So you know what I'm saying? And so I just wanted to hear your viewpoint on it, because I don't think this is right to be taxed, and you can be a conscientious objector and not go to a combat. I'll serve. I mean, I'll go do something.
You know, I can tell you're a really good person, Joyce, and all of us feel this way. We want our freedom. You don't have to be a Catholic to believe in freedom and to be opposed to this law. And by the way, some of the lawsuits are being brought by other religious groups, not just Catholics. But thank you for calling, and Happy New Year. Enjoy your
thank
new
you.
Year, and we'll stay together and fight for freedom. We're coming up to a break, but I do want to say this. I'm standing in for Laura Ingram, the great voice of freedom. And when we get back, we're going to be talking with Christopher Horner from the Competitive Enterprise Institute about some of the environmental protection hogwash we've heard this year.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful.
Welcome back. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingram. And I'm playing that song for you because over half the United States, the continental United States, is blanketed in snow. And we've invited Christopher Horner, one of the nation's experts on on the holes we can poke in global warming, to join us in just a couple of minutes. He's a fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute and a very well-known lawyer in Washington, D.C. But first, the board has lit up with calls about Obamacare, and we're going to take a couple of them. Rebecca from Kentucky, thank you for calling.
Hello, Betsy. I heard recently that the elderly outnumbered the young people in going to the polls to vote, because, you know, we've been voting for so many years. But what if the elderly told Congress that unless they change this Medicare thing, you know, of robbing the Obamacare, robbing the Medicare, if we told them that we weren't going to go to the vote polls and vote for them, do you think they would jump in there and do something about it?
Well, Rebecca, I'm really glad you called about this, but instead of refusing to vote, I suggest respectfully that you vote for opponents of Obamacare, because then your vote is more powerful. In other words, let's make this coming election, 2014, a referendum on Obamacare, and show how powerful the senior vote is. There is nothing else we can do about this except vote these buggers out.
Well, is it actually going to come to a vote? Is it already said that it's going to come to a vote?
Well, the law has been enacted, but The fact is, as you can see, the president has constantly changed this law, and before it is fully in effect and destroying Medicare, it's time to repeal it. And in order to repeal it, we need a Republican majority in the United States Senate. It's very likely that we will win a Republican majority if seniors, are you a senior, Rebecca?
Yes, I'm a senior.
Good for you. If seniors like you turn out en masse to vote for opponents of Obamacare, and I hope you will. Thank you for your call, and Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Peter, what's on your mind?
Hi.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing? Thank you for taking my call. I was just calling, you know, you saw about the, if you pay 1%, we you know, like, I can't think right now, about the Obamacare law, if you don't pay it, you know, you can pay, it's less.
I see what you're getting at, Peter. You're saying the fine is smaller than the amount you're going to be losing if you buy Obamacare. And you're quite right about that, because not only are the premiums very high, but have you seen the deductibles? They're about double what most people are used to. $5,500 for an individual in a bronze plan, $11,000 for a family. Imagine having health insurance and having an $11,000 family deductible before you get paid back for the cost you incur.
Right. Even though it's going to go up substantially, it's less than the insurance that we'll be paying. I think we got to get that out.
You're so right. I'm really glad you called to point that out. And I hope you have a happy new year. And let's all make a pledge that in the new year, one of the things we are going to do is get rid of Obamacare. Okay, Peter is gone. Now we're teeing up for Christopher Horner. And I'm so glad he's coming on, because this year, like so many times, President Obama has made, quote, environmental protection what he says is one of the hallmarks of his administration. Now, he hasn't been able to get through Congress some of his most draconian approaches, for example, against the coal industry. So he is illegally doing it by regulation instead. Christopher Horner, a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, is the expert on the administration's approach to now we'll call it climate change, since clearly it's not warming. So, Mr. Horner, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Bethy.
Okay, so tell us, why are we in such trouble with the Obama administration? What are they doing illegally that they can't get done legally?
In a way, you answered that question. When the proper democratic process failed him, he decided he didn't need the proper democratic process, and that he was going to, as he so often says he would really like to, not wait around for Congress. So the constitutional law professor, which he wasn't, the lecturer in civil rights jurisprudence, decided that EPA should implement what had been decided by his movement. Again, this is not something he knows anything about. It's just that the political left has decided that scarcity is the way to go. It, of course, reduces the delusions of adequacy among the masses, that they can make decisions for themselves, decide what to use, how to use it, when to use it, and so on. And so they're imposing this energy scarcity agenda, the cap and trade scheme, essentially, the cap without the trade, through EPA by regulatory fiat. And the big problem is something gets a little pointy-headed, and that's this doctrine against delegation. We have Congress passing typically vague, but not always, but always broad, sweeping grants of power to agencies, the unelected, who decide that they will wait around until they're tired of waiting around for the elected to give them details, and then they will do what they wish. And the courts have decided in the past few decades, Betsy, that, you know what, you're the experts. You're the agencies. We will defer to your expertise, though it's typically just ideology. And if you think that's what the law says, you think that the law says 250 tons, for example, and you think it really means 250,000 tons, so you can try to just regulate people you really hate, well, we'll let you rewrite the law as bureaucrats and so on. That's a real example from this war.
The problem is that we're losing our our God-given right to self-government as a result. We are in the hands of the bureaucrats. I see it with Obamacare. Just in the last segment, I was talking about the fact that that law empowers the Secretary of Health and Human Services with blanket authority to regulate all doctors. Can you imagine?
So, okay.
You're
that
saying
law provided them that. Okay, and we know how that law was crammed down. This Clean Air Act, amended several times, the Congress always rejected making it a global warming law. Every single time, some wackadoodle would bring it up, and it would always be rejected. And so now the agencies decided, yes, Congress rejected it, but we're going to decide the law says this. And the courts so far have let them because they say, you're the experts. They're generally the ideologues.
What about coal-fired plants? I hear that the president's war on coal is going to cost a lot of jobs in this country.
Already has. I pull these heartbreaking screenshots all the time for talks I give. They are trying to wipe out an industry simply because it's been politically deselected. And it's been politically deselected because it's so abundant. We have centuries of coal, which we burn more cleanly than anybody ever thought possible. So they move from pollution to redefine pollution to saying, well, you're changing the weather. And then when their computer models don't come true, they say, well, we've got a reason. There's a pause. My models are probably right, and what you're seeing out the window is wrong. And so they're shutting down coal plants now. They're killing investment in coal here out of fear of what they're doing, and they're trying to make sure we can't even export it to the rest of the world, which, by the way, is not going along with this moon battery. So it's very, very heartbreaking. They are ruining livelihoods. They are destroying communities, centuries-old communities, that are simply because they're part of an industry that has been politically deselected.
Now, are these communities going to get a political revenge against the Obama administration? I mean, coal is very big in states like West Virginia and even southern Ohio. Am I correct? Pennsylvania?
And various states, in fact. Many states mine coal. It's very important in Kentucky and West Virginia and Virginia and so on. But remember, we still get it's in the 40% now, but nearly half of our electricity from coal. And so everybody, you're talking about seniors choosing between heating and eating. How do we know? Because they said, look to Europe, that's what he's trying to do. Well, in Europe, tens of thousands died, according to left-wing newspapers last winter, from fuel poverty because of this war on affordable energy. So we know what's going to happen. It's not just the mining communities, though I beg to tell you that I think that's sufficient because this is simply out of politics and ideology, not substance or science or observations. You shouldn't be killing these communities in Appalachia, but they're imposing the pain all across the country. It's going to go much further than that in any industry depending upon a competitive advantage, for example, premised in affordable, reliable electricity, which has always been our edge. Well, tough luck.
So you're making it more costly for all people, and including seniors, to just run their households, to buy electricity.
By design. And remember, they're saying, well, Obamacare's not working out as we planned, and so we're fixing the glitches. It's not a bug. It's a feature. It was the point. They have said, they have said for decades, this movement, that the worst thing for the world is abundant, reliable energy. And if we invented pixie dust or flubber, they'd have to do something to control that. Because they're not against everything. They're fiercely supportive of scarcity and control. And so things that are abundant, they loved natural gas. Oh, well, if you just swear off coal, we'll let you have natural gas. Then it turns out we have a lot of natural gas. The same groups, if you just click them out on a different page, have a war on gas webpage now.
Oh, how about fracking?
It's abundant.
They're destroying the movement toward fracking in many states, including a New York state where I live. The southern tier of New York is deeply in poverty. It's just a crisis, and fracking would turn it around. And Andrew Cuomo, a close ally of President Obama, has refused to approve fracking in New York state.
Right, and if you just go over the border, although Mr. Cuomo sees a president in the mirror when he shaves, he's got this economic basket case. And meanwhile, Pennsylvania's thriving in part. Their lone bright spot is fracking. He's going to have to explain that, and my guess is it's not going to be overly honestly.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us today, Christopher Horner. I hope you'll come back on the show again because you are just a font of information. Christopher Horner's latest book is The Liberal War on Transparency. I hope next time you'll talk more about this. And Happy New Year to a really smart pro-environmentalist who actually talks the truth about science. Thank you, Christopher Horner.
Thank you. To you, too.
It's really great to hear a straight story instead of all the fear-mongering from the global warming us. I say global warming, bah humbug. And we'll be back after the break. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, standing in for the great voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Stayed with me. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham. And we're celebrating together New Year's just a bit early. In the last segment, I was talking with one of the real experts in Washington, D.C. on the liberal war on fuel, Christopher Horner from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And it reminded me that I had promised to give you something of a crystal ball looking ahead into politics in 2014. And I will say that one of the clearest trends is that Americans are voting with their feet to go to states that are friendly to fossil fuel. Red states are rising. And when I say red states, I mean states with Republican policies, states that are low tax, low regulation, and pro fossil fuel. And one of the most obvious examples hit me very close to home. All the headlines last week announced that New York State, which is currently the third largest state in the nation in terms of popularity, is falling into fourth place as Florida, a red state, surges ahead. Of course, Florida doesn't have an income tax. Florida has less business regulation. You've probably seen all those ads on Fox News. Hey, it's not how much you make, it's how much you get to keep. And in New York State, you don't get to keep much. And in addition, Andrew Cuomo's war on fracking is destroying the biggest industrial opportunity that Western and Southern New York has. There's a stretch of New York State close to my heart called the Southern Tier, from Chautauqua all the way through Binghamton and Elmira. And unfortunately, this area really needs fracking to build business opportunity. Right across the border in Pennsylvania, things are thriving. But on the New York side, it's very sad. Economically, it's in the doldrums, and it's because of Governor Andrew Cuomo's war on fracking. California is also pursuing some very unwise anti-fuel policies. So you're going to see more and more Americans leaving those high-tax, high-regulation, energy-hostile states and moving to states that promote growth. That's prediction number one. Prediction number two, and I feel pretty confident on this one, 2014 will be a referendum on Obamacare. The polls are showing rapid movement. More and more Americans, not just Republicans, but independents and Democrats, are rejecting Obamacare. They don't want the government nosing into their medical care. They don't want the government forcing them to buy an exorbitantly priced health insurance policy. And they don't like what Obamacare is doing to seniors. Of course, Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid are in la-la land. They're still saying it's going to be a glorious thing. It will be a great weapon of victory for Democratic politicians in 2014. But most members of the United States Senate know that's not true. The Democrats have all but given up any hope of gaining the House, and it looks as if they may well lose the United States Senate this fall. Of course, in politics, 9 or 10 months is an eternity. Anything can happen. But right now, peering into that crystal ball, it looks as if Obamacare is turning things around politically in these United States. So those are two predictions. And my third is a happy one. And I mentioned it earlier. And that is more and more federal courts are ruling, if you like your God, you can keep your God. More and more federal judges are ruling that those who have religious scruples against the part of Obamacare that compels coverage to include contraceptives, abortion drugs, and sterilization do not have to comply. Not only churches, but not-for-profits, and even companies like Hobby Lobby that are simply owned and operated by people who want to adhere to their view of what's religiously right. So it's good to see that in the United States, even though the Veterans Administration is waging a war on religion, even though the president himself is waging a war on religion, can you imagine? This president is even being sued by an order of nuns. That's the most politically foolish thing I've ever seen, for the president to go to war with the nuns. Anyway, the federal courts are standing up for the First Amendment. These cases will be in the Supreme Court soon, and I project victory ahead for those of us who believe in the First Amendment. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham, the voice of freedom, and we will be back after the break to talk with one of my favorite congressmen, and he's my favorite because he truly believes in liberty, Congressman Steve King. Welcome back. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York, author of Beating Obamacare, here to celebrate New Year's a bit early with you. I'm standing in for the voice of liberty, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA and tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle. And you can reach me at BetsyMcCoy.com. In just a moment, we're going to be talking to what I believe is one of the real soldiers for freedom, Congressman Steve King from Iowa. But first, we have Angela on the line. Angela, thanks for calling.
Yes. Hello, Betsy. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. What are you thinking today?
I was listening to you speak about how Obamacare could actually debit the funds from your tax refunds and withhold those from you.
That's right.
I'm thinking if you look into it, it's even just a little scarier than that, because in the bill itself, it authorizes the government to do electronic funds transfers. And what that means is basically they have complete and total access to any and all of your bank accounts.
Well, let me just jump in here, Angela, because I've heard that many times. But as you know, I've read the bill, the law, thoroughly, and I haven't found that. I'm not aware of a portion of the law that actually enables the federal government to go into your bank accounts and take money out. So, if you have a section number, let me know, or you can email me, betsy@hospitalinfection.org. But right now, I don't think that that's actually true. So I'll look into it further, and you stay in touch with me, and thanks for calling. Now, let me introduce Congressman Steve King. And the reason I asked him to come on is that, as far as I'm concerned, the biggest challenge in the year ahead is not necessarily to repeal Obamacare, although I'm committed to that. But in addition, and more importantly, it's to protect and defend our United States Constitution. And few people in Congress are doing more on that score than Congressman Steve King. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on, Betsy. I appreciate the chance to talk with you today.
Well, if you could explain to our listeners what your concerns are about President Obama's violations of the rule of law.
Oh, his violations have been multiple. The starkest one, I think the people will be easiest to understand and identify with, will be the times that he has decided that he's not going to enforce immigration law. He's refused to allow ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement, to enforce the specific law that says to ICE, when you encounter someone that's in the United States illegally, you shall place them in removal proceedings. That's Congress's directive to the executive branch, whose job it is to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Well, that's just one of about five violations on immigration. And then the president is making things up as he goes along. And one of them is issuing work permits to people that he has now legalized by his executive edict. That's the immigration piece. Another one that's clear to understand, and not many people have raised the issue on this because they're glad he did it, but when he delayed the employer mandate in Obamacare,
oh, yes.
The bill says clearly that it shall, that the employer mandate shall commence in each month after December of 2013.
And that wasn't a victimless crime, by the way, because once he delayed the employer mandate, of course it's going to mean a bigger bill for taxpayers who are footing the bill for the subsidies on the health insurance exchanges.
Yes, and the price to our Constitution, which is a priceless guarantee, a priceless contract from generation to generation, it gets eroded. And when he delayed the individual mandate, also unconstitutional, we could go outside of Obamacare and go into the welfare to work, which was passed over Bill Clinton's objection and eventual signature in the 90s. There's only one of the 80 different means-tested federal welfare programs we have, and that's 10 of temporary assistance to needy families that requires work. And it's written in such a way that it's to prohibit and prevent the president from waiving the work component. Well, he did anyway. And then No Child Left Behind simply left those children behind and decided not to implement No Child Left Behind. I don't know that I have
Tell everyone what No Child Left Behind is in case somebody doesn't know?
Well, I said it was legislation that was passed on education. With when George Bush was elected, he and Teddy Kennedy got together and came to a compromise. And it is a federal subsidy that goes into schools and into all of our K-12 schools. And then they have to then they're rated according to the progress and the growth that their students make. And some of the schools that were sitting at the top, there wasn't another rung on the ladder for them to climb into. But the president has just decided that he will waive certain portions of No Child Left Behind. I've not looked into the nuanced details of it. But another one would be when the president decided after Obamacare was passed, when especially the Catholic Church, but the faith community rose up and said, we don't have this conscience protection that we're supposed to have. You cannot compel us under Obamacare to fund contraceptives, abortion-causing pills, or sterilizations. And there are some multiple dozens of lawsuits brought forward, many by the Catholic Church. Well, after 2 weeks of political heat, the president stepped out into the Rose Garden at the podium at noon on a Friday, a typical, and he said, now I'm going to make an accommodation to the religious organizations. I'm now going to require the insurance companies to provide these things for free. And he repeated himself, for free. And we went back and scoured through not just the law, which we knew hadn't changed, but the regulations, which might have. No regulation was changed. No language was changed in print anywhere. The president spoke, and the insurance companies lined up to provide those services, not for free, but charge all of us, of course, back charge all of us for those. They really aren't services. But, Betsy, I know you know this piece of it. It's so frustrating to watch the Constitution be eroded piece by piece and know that there are many members of Congress who take the same oath I did that don't have an ounce of heartburn over it.
Well, that's exactly what we were getting at. That's what I was hoping you would address, because the fact is this president is trying to govern like a dictator. I don't want to sound extreme. You and I aren't extremists. But this president has trampled the Constitution. And when one president gets away with it, it sets a precedent for future executives. And that means that we are losing our ability to be a self-governing people because we are gradually empowering this dictator. Last week, I saw six members of the Senate, all Democrats, literally go to the president hat in hand and ask for some sort of accommodation for people who had lost their health plans instead of formulating legislation to do it the right way. What was your thought on that one?
Oh, it's like, my last name's King, but I don't play off of that. It's like the subjects going to the king and waiting outside of his anteroom where he sits in his throne, and with their hat in their hand and lining up and trying to pick the right day and say, can you grant this wish, Mr. President? He's not a king. He's only the president. I would reinforce that. Barack Obama and all of his predecessors were only the president of the United States. They're not God, and we should treat them like an elected official. They are limited by the Constitution. And these bright lines that we have between the executive, the legislative, and the judicial branches of government were carefully crafted by our founding fathers and the drafters, and they were, of course, ratified. And our founding fathers envisioned that there would be a static tension between the three branches of government that would set about to define the differences between the three branches in that area that they have drawn. And they never imagined that any branch of government would be so aggressive in usurping the constitutional authority of another branch, the Article I legislative branch. And they never imagined that the people who were elected to the United States Congress would not jealously and vigorously guard the power and authority that they have under the Constitution.
Yes,
so there's two things wrong here.
And really, it's almost as disturbing to see how unwilling, almost how uninterested so many members of Congress are in performing their constitutional duty and upholding the powers of Congress, because those powers don't just belong to Congress. They belong to us, the American people.
Well, they do. And when they're participating in a political practice that erodes our Constitution, they're handing off a legacy to the next generation that's going to be awfully hard to restore. And, you know, I often inform people that this Constitution exists the way it is because we have great reverence for it. It is an institution in the American culture and civilization. When I've got a copy, an original copy of the new Egyptian Constitution. And I know that I've sat down with the Chief Justice of the Chinese Supreme Court, and I presented him a signed copy of a U.S. Constitution. He said, I've read this, I've studied it. And he said, our Constitution is very much the same. Well, it may be. You can hand the American Constitution over to any people on earth, but if they don't revere it and protect it and defend it, then it's useless and meaningless. And
that's right.
The difference between our American Constitution.
Well, and in this country, the rule of law is king, not Mr. Obama. But he hasn't gotten the message. And what is your view on how optimistic or pessimistic we should be in the coming year?
Well, I think it's wrapped up in Obamacare, how it's deployed. And, you know, as we've discussed this, I don't know if we've quite said it, but it seems as though that a lot of members of Congress are making their constitutional decisions on what they think is politically expedient and then contriving their argument to fit their political expediency attitude. So there are some Democrats that are starting to decide that it's politically expedient for them to start to take a position against some parts of Obamacare, get relief from Obamacare. When the first Democrat, especially the first incumbent, steps up and says, I am going to run on the ticket of the full repeal of Obamacare, I think that starts a mini stampede that could turn this thing over. That's something to look forward to in 2014. And if that doesn't happen, it'll be a hard-fought election in 2014.
Yes.
And finally, we'll have an election on Obamacare. I don't think it was on 2012. Cut it out, Betsy.
Well, what I was going to say is that I'd like to see the Democrats stampede not only for repeal, and I agree with you, I think that that is going to happen, but also stampede to stand up for the Constitution, because we're seeing the violations not only over Obamacare, but over environmental issues, which Christopher Horner discussed earlier in the show, over immigration, which you discussed just a moment ago, in virtually every area of American lawmaking, the president has tried to seize the power to make the laws on his own.
I'm really sorry I missed Chris Horner. He has a lot to say about especially the environmental issues. I'm extraordinarily impressed with him.
Well,
and if he's, go ahead, Betsy.
I was just going to say, I'm sure he's impressed with you, too. Go ahead.
Well, thank you.
You two ought to get together because you've held some terrific hearings on the violations of the Constitution, and I'd like to see you delve into it even more, and Christopher Horner would be a good witness. I want to say thank you to you for standing up for the Constitution. Thank you for being a great American. Thank you for all you do in the United States Congress, Congressman Steve King.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate you having me on.
You're quite welcome. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham, your healthy radio addiction. And when we come back from this break, a few closing thoughts on New Year's Eve.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind?
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Wonder whose arms will hold you good and tight when it's exactly 12 o'clock that night, welcoming in the new year.
This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for Laura Ingram, the voice of liberty. And I want to thank you for joining me for this pre-New Year's celebration. So nice to ring out the old and ring in the new with you. We've celebrated the life of Margaret Thatcher, paying homage to her commitment to freedom and economic liberty. We've talked about Obamacare and more or less pledged together to defeat it in the coming year. We spoke with Congressman Steve King about the importance of the rule of law, the bedrock of American freedom. We talked with Christopher Horner about the phony, baloney global warming fears. Bah humbug to global warming. Half of the United States is covered in snow at the moment, and the ice in the Arctic Circle is thicker than ever. And we've considered a few political predictions for the coming year. It's all been a lot of fun. What we didn't talk about, and I hope we can for just a moment, is find out if your member of Congress, the person representing you, is taking that illegal subsidy, allowing the taxpayer to pay for their Obamacare plan in the coming year. If they are, you should put them on a roster of shame and make sure they are never elected to high office again. As we close, let me just suggest this. I won't be with you tomorrow on New Year's Eve, but whether you're alone or with family and friends, look up into that clear night sky and thank your lucky stars for being an American. It's a real privilege. But freedom isn't free. It depends on you and me. And in the new year, we need to pledge to take our obligations as citizens more seriously than ever before and hold those politicians feet to the fire. In addition, of course, it might be nice when you get a chance to do what Robert Burns suggested in Auld Lang Syne and offer a cup of kindness wherever you can. So welcome in 2014. I predict it's going to be the year of victory for those of us who are committed to freedom. And with that, I will close. Happy New Year to all of you. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram, the voice of liberty. Happy New Year.
Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountain majesties above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good will.